Good day to everybody. I'm very happy to be here in Wales. Why am I so happy to be here? Because the weather here is worse than in Germany. So whenever I'm in Berlin now and the weather's really shitty, I will think, well, it's not that bad. But I don't want you to feel bad about the weather here. In case you do live here, I want you all to feel good. That's why I'm going to talk about mental health, because we all have a mental health, I guess. And hopefully you will hear something today which will, you know, maybe help you to get a better mental health. Because I'm going to talk about, outside I think on the board it says psychedelics and Nazi Germany, which is a very weird combination. But after this half an hour talk, after which you have the possibility to ask me some questions, you will understand a bit better how they are connected and how they are also connected actually, and this is most dear to me personally for this talk, but with the health, mental health of my mother. That is the big kind of arch we're trying to construct, or at least I have to construct, I guess. That's why the book, there's a book about this, I think has a terrible cover. Because this is not my mother, you see. This is some scary-looking German dude, I think even from First World War. I don't even think this is a Second World War guy. So this, I told my UK publisher, please change the cover. I show you the American cover, it's also very bad. Looks like this. I mean, my daughter, she's 17 years old. She told me recently, she asked me about my new book. She said, are there Nazis in it again? And I said, yeah, actually, it's not only about Nazis, but they appear again. And she said, good, because Nazis and Heidi, those are the two things that sell out of the German-speaking world. Heidi's not in it. Yeah. So this is the American cover. I show you now the Slovenian cover, and you will be amazed. Look at this. This is a good cover. Also in Slovenia, maybe this is Slavoj Žižek's influence, I have no idea, or maybe they're just a funky country. They decided to call the book LSD for Mom, and that was actually my working title. Because, like, tripped, I don't know. I mean, I wrote a book called Blitzed, which is just focused on drugs in Nazi Germany. So I guess in the UK and the US, they thought Blitzed was a big success. Now we call the new book Tripped, and everyone will, like, you know, buy the other one too. It's like a sequel. But actually, the new book, what I'm talking about today, LSD for Mom, is a very different animal. So I'm gonna go into the subject matter right now. What am I talking about? When I researched Blitzed, I was like looking at methamphetamine in the German army, Hitler's drug abuse, very, I guess, serious and dark topic. And I was also in the most serious of all places, which is the archives of the former concentration camp of Dachau. Because I was looking all over Germany into archives, how did the Nazis abuse drugs for their evil deeds? And while I was in the concentration camp of Dachau's archive, the archivist showed me records that related to psychedelic experiments that the Nazis did on camp inmates. And that was very odd, because before that, all the drugs that the Nazis were using were methamphetamine for the soldiers and opioids for, like, Hitler used a lot of opioids, but psychedelics and Nazis, it just doesn't add up. At least in my head, it didn't add up. So when I saw that in Dachau, I thought this could be very interesting, and I asked the archivist, can I see all the records? And he said, well, they've all been taken by the Americans when they liberated the camp, because the military comes in, liberates a camp, and then also takes all the paperwork that's there, you know, that's, it's kind of normal. So I couldn't really look at the full extent of the Nazi psychedelic research, but it was in the back of my mind. And I thought I have to find them at one point in time. And this might be another book. So when I started work on LSD for Mom, which at first had no title. It was just a book that I thought maybe I can somehow tell the story of psychedelics, understanding what the Nazis did with them, because psychedelics have a very weird history. You know, if you look at LSD, LSD has like the most complicated history of any compound, and it was developed in 43 by a pharmaceutical company in Switzerland, and they thought this is a mental health product. So what happened to LSD? Why is it now this weird thing that was made illegal in the 60s that people are afraid of, that you jump out of the window? I mean, I thought, can I somehow make sense of this story? Is that somehow connected maybe to what happened in Dachau concentration camp? That was like my original idea. And while I was thinking that and starting the research, and now comes my mom into play. She suffers from dementia, started suffering from dementia, from Alzheimer actually. And in the early research, I also looked at how is LSD being used right now, because companies, startup companies, pharmaceutical startups are now looking at compounds like LSD again. As you probably all know, it's the so-called psychedelic renaissance. Now they're suddenly very interesting again. So I found a study done by an American company called Eleusis. They did a clinical study with microdoses of LSD for Alzheimer patients. And they found in their first tests that they did with patients that that LSD actually stimulates the so-called 5-HT2A receptors in the brain. We all have these receptors, the serotonin receptors. They're very important for our neuronal network. And LSD stimulates these very receptors. And at the same, the same receptors are degenerating under Alzheimer. So that was the idea of that startup. And they actually found that patients get better, have cognitive enhancement or improvements, and this is the study that I found. But it's an early, so-called phase one study. You have to go through three phases if you want to bring a new medication onto the market, and each phase has more participants and it's more expensive to actually bring a new medication onto the market, for several hundred million euros or pounds or dollars, because in phase three you have lots of people taking part. It's very expensive. So this was a phase one. Phase one is just kind of, it gives you an indication that maybe something is interesting, and then you try to go into phase two, raise money, etc. So I showed this phase one study to my father and to my mother. And my father is really, he's taking care of my mother. So he's, I mean, Alzheimer's is a weird disease. The people who actually have it might suffer less, it sounds absurd, than the people who take care of these people. Because like my mother at the moment, she doesn't know that she has Alzheimer. And she's, I mean, I wouldn't say she's happy, certainly not, because it does, you know, it's a horrible disease. But especially for my father, the job of taking care of her becomes extremely frustrating, because there's no, well, not extremely challenging. The frustrating part is that there's no medication on the market. There's no, like, against dementia, there's nothing, basically. So when he read that study, he became interested. And my father is a former judge, quite a high judge in Germany. So a serious person for sure. He told me, I'm not a drug person. I'm a man of the law, which he is, you know, he was, he's now retired. And he said, something is not right here, you know. I'm reading this scientific study that it helps, but then it's illegal. I mean, I sent people to prison for drugs. Like, something doesn't add up, obviously. So he said to me, when I was still active in court, the challenge was for me as a judge to find out what is the truth. And it's actually quite difficult, you know, what is the truth? And he basically said the truth is the best story in court, which I thought was quite a progressive, maybe even post-modern approach, you know. You have, you know, evidence and whatever. And if someone confesses and the evidence point, then it's probably the truth that he did that, or he or she did that. But often it's hard for a judge to actually find out. And he said, you have, as a judge, you have to develop a feeling for the right story that rings true. So if you, my son, now tell me I should give LSD to my wife, you better bring me the true story of LSD and why is it illegal and what actually is LSD. So that kind of set me on the research. Then the book really started. And that is also how I constructed it, like in the book, in the beginning. You know, I meet, you know, then I go into the research, and now we all go into that story to understand. He said, bring me something that holds up in court. So we'll see if I can bring something back that holds up in court. What is LSD? This is not LSD, but these black things here, it's so-called Claviceps purpurea, also you can say in English, I think, ergot. In German, it's Mutterkorn, which means mother's corn. And Mutterkorn, which I think is a great word actually for it, ergot, grows on rye. It's a parasitical fungus that actually created a lot of problems in Europe in the Middle Ages. They're like, you probably know some of these apocalyptic paintings where like people have like weird animal faces, and like at least we had in Europe ergot poisonings, and probably in other parts of the world too, on a grand scale. And ergot was always like the enemy of the farmers. Like when you harvest the rye, and it only grows on rye, it doesn't grow on wheat, which is also a reason why wheat became more and more dominant, because ergot poisoning was a big problem. Now, even nowadays, ergot poisoning can be a problem. The last poisoning in Germany happened in the mid-80s when like a small organic shop was selling ergot-infested muesli, you know? Because usually it's like filtered out, but it still can happen. So ergot is what inside of these things are alkaloids, very potent alkaloids, and out of those come medications, including LSD, which company did develop this? It's Sandoz. Sandoz is a company in Basel, Switzerland. They started after First World War. They were first producing just colors, and they made a lot of money, especially after the First World War. Everything had to be repainted, and they thought, we don't want to pay like half of our gains to the tax man in Switzerland. We want to reinvest it. So they reinvested in the pharmaceutical branch. They hired a guy called Arthur Stoll, who was like a Swiss pharmacological pioneer. And he said, I'm going to crack ergot. I'm going to extract the potent alkaloids, and I'm going to turn them into medicines. Because what ergot does, it contracts your blood vessels. And the first medication that Sandoz created in the 20s was a migraine medicine, because if you have migraine and then the blood vessels are contracted, the pain goes away, or at least that's how it works. So ergot was really Sandoz's specialty, and they were making lots of money from ergot. At one point they even decided, oh, this is ergot, like a microscopic, it looks like a mushroom actually now. LSD basically is a mushroom. So this is a microscopic photo of ergot. What the company did was they employed Swiss women like her to inoculate the rye with the ergot spores to create more ergot, because they were making so many medicines from ergot and making so much money. The farmers, it's in a certain valley in Switzerland called the Emmental, they make cheese and ergot. I went there, it was interesting. They don't do it anymore, but ergot is still a big product in the pharmaceutical world. Still, medicines use ergot. So the farmers actually at the time, in the 30s, when they did it, they were shocked. Like suddenly they had to make ergot. Like before they were always trying to destroy ergot, and suddenly they were making it. But they were being paid per kilo of ergot, I think 20 francs, while rye, they only made like 5 francs or something. So they were convinced, now am I going to make ergot? So they made a lot of ergot, And the company then employed more chemists, and one of these chemists, maybe you know the name, who then developed and found LSD, you know him. Albert Hofmann. Who said it? Very good. Albert Hofmann was a very normal Swiss chemist, and his job was to create more medicines from ergot. And he was also looking for, they also made a medicine that was still is on the market. Now Sandoz is Novartis, which is, I think, the seventh biggest pharmaceutical company in the world, still in Basel. They bought Sandoz, Novartis bought Sandoz in the 90s. Now it's Novartis. They still have a medication that they give after a woman gives birth, because after the birth, sometimes the bleeding doesn't stop. And with that medication, I think it's called Hidergin or something, the blood vessels, arteries contract, and then the bleeding stops. So Hofmann was also looking for new medications, and he was creating all kinds of compounds out of this ergot. He made 25 different compounds, and the 25th compound was he extracted the acid out. There's an acid within the ergot, and he turned, it's called lysergic acid, and he turned that into a diethylamide. And don't ask me, please, what is a diethylamide? I just don't know. I've asked a few chemists, and they've explained it to me. It's not that difficult, but I can't grasp it. But it's lysergic acid diethylamide. You can do that from the ergot, and that is the abbreviation, obviously, is LSD. And it was the 25th compound he made, so that's why LSD in the beginning was called LSD-25. And he had this LSD-25, and they gave it to mice like they always do at Sandoz, and the mice, they didn't feel anything. That's what I wrote in my book, and it's actually wrong. Because maybe they did feel something, but no one saw it. Like, the mice were taking LSD, and they were just... I mean, one was sitting cross-legged then. They should have seen that, but they just thought it's a crazy mouse, you know? One mouse was jumping out of the window, and they also thought... It's not related to LSD. So they kind of shelved LSD in 1938. LSD was dead in 1938. No one thought about it anymore. But then Hofmann, 5 years later, for reasons he could never explain, did it again. Because really they had harvested so much ergot, and he kind of had in his mind, maybe the mice did feel something, I don't know. He did it again in 43, and when he synthesized it again, very sober Swiss chemist, somehow, and he also couldn't explain how, somehow something got into his system, like maybe into the, because LSD, the weird thing about LSD is it's potent in very, very small quantities, microgram quantities. You can take the most dangerous toxin in the world, which I think is cobra toxin. It's a toxin from the cobra. If you take it in microgram dosages, you don't feel anything. But if you take LSD in microgram dosages, you feel something. So he suddenly felt like he was in the lab, and so, and he thought, something's working on me, but I didn't even take anything. I mean, how did I maybe come? Maybe fumes came into my eyes, or maybe I had a cut, or I mean, he was a properly working chemist. So he became curious, and 3 days, this was on a Friday, and on a Monday, which is April 19th, 1943, the famous day, which today is Bicycle Day, yes. Today, LSD enthusiasts all over the world on that day ride bicycles on LSD. Why do they do that? They do it because Hofmann took 250 micrograms, which is a quarter of a milligram. He thought, I'm not going to feel anything. And I studied his lab book. Like, he had a book like this, and he wrote like 4 p.m., 250 micrograms. And at 4:30, he's like, no effect. And he wanted to take more. And then at 4:50, he wrote like, and then I can see that his writing becomes a bit, and then the effect started. And he got a bit scared because he didn't know what it was. So he said to his assistant, a young Fräulein with the weird name of Rammstein, Fräulein Rammstein, Susie Rammstein, 19 years old, he said to her, Fräulein Rammstein, do we have any Swiss people in the audience? Because Well, I like to imitate a Swiss accent, but I don't do it when Swiss people are around. Because it's language shaming, and that's not good. Fräulein Rammstein, I feel a bit strange. I can't even do it in English, you know, it's ridiculous. So she said, okay, let's maybe go home. And he came with a bicycle that day. He had come with a bicycle, so they went to the bicycle stand, and he got on the bike, and the trip got quite strong, and this is the famous bicycle ride home, you know. He just wanted to get home. And it was a very strong trip. 250 micrograms, I don't know if you have LSD experience, is a strong trip. And if you've never taken LSD, and if you don't even know that what LSD is, like he didn't know, you know, it's very strong, you know. Because what happens in the brain is that and he didn't know this, of course, actually took several decades until we know now what happened to his brain, or what happened to everyone who takes LSD. LSD changes the neurochemistry while you're on it in a way that it decreases the energy flow to the command center. There's a command center in each of our brains, which, for example, tells me now that, my God, we have to come to the Q&A soon, but I haven't even... Okay, the command center tells me it's important that I finish up the story and wrap it up, and there's still like at least 10, 15 minutes until we... And you have a command center, you're sitting there, you're at the festival, everything is okay. And the command center receives less energy, which means that other parts of the brain have the ability to be more active, you could say. Like, you can measure this. It has been measured since the early 90s in brain scanners with people on LSD, that peripheral sections of the brain start interacting, and there's a lot less judgment, because the command center judges, like, I see you, you're a bit skeptical, or whatever, or you're very happy. Like, that's also judgment. But if that is removed, then you just let it, you know, you just accept what's around you. So, but if you don't know that you're taking LSD, and suddenly you can't really make those judgments anymore, then maybe it gets scary. That's why it's very bad to give LSD to people without telling them. Which is exactly what the CIA did, and we come to the CIA in a second. So Hoffman goes home, and he has the trip, and he talks to Stoll, his CEO, that this is very potent, and I don't know what this is. And Stoll, of course, became very interested in it, because this seemed to be something that works on the brain in a very interesting way. Today we know it because of these effects that I just explained. It increases neuroplasticity. What is neuroplasticity? That's basically the ability of our brain to be fluid, flexible, create new neuronal connections. And this is, our brain is not like a bone, you know. Our brain is a living, fluid, soft organ. And today we know that actually new neuronal connections are being formed under LSD. That's why some researchers call it a brain food, or that's even healthy to take LSD in small dosages. If the effect is not overwhelming, even now there's research for the so-called non-psychedelic psychedelic, like an LSD type, where you don't have a trip, you just have the neuronal enhancement effect. Yeah, so it's a very interesting medication. And Stoll, being the CEO of Sandoz, he senses that there's something going on. This is maybe a bestseller, you know, a big hit. And he communicated this, and now we come to the Nazis. He communicated this to this guy. You probably can't read it, but I'll explain it to you. Professor Dr. Kuhn. Who was this guy? He was the best friend of the Swiss CEO, Stoll, because they had had the same mentor when they were learning chemistry, which was a Jewish-German biochemist who received the Nobel Prize, Richard Willstetter. Willstetter had these two great, you know, students. One was Stoll, the CEO of Sandoz, and the other one was Kuhn. And Kuhn was a German, and when the Nazis took power, Kuhn didn't leave Germany. He continued his research, his work, and if you did that as a scientist in Nazi Germany, you had to become complicit. You basically had to become a Nazi, otherwise you left. You know, you can't. And Kuhn, actually, he seemed to have liked the Nazis. Like, he would start his lectures at university with the Hitler salute, and so he was a Nazi. But for Stoll, this was not a problem, really. They had been exchanging knowledge since the early 20s. They had been best friends, research buddies. So in 43, Stoll also said to Kuhn, we have this crazy thing that works on the mind. And also, Kuhn was, he knew about, you know, the ERGOT research, like they've, like, show it to me, send it to me. And I found in the Novartis archive, I found this letter where he states, in November 43, that he received, you know, he talks about his daughter. He has a daughter with the name Linde, which is not so important, except for the daughter and for the family. But what is important for world history is that he received 5 × 0.1 grams of ergotamine tartrate, which is a precursor to LSD. If you have that, it's just it's very easy for a chemist to change that into LSD. Maybe it was even LSD, and because they didn't have a real name for it then, but so he had the material. And that's basically the smoking gun. Because that thing, because why? Kuhn was not only developing, I think it's sarin, which was the deadly and still is the most deadly nerve poison or nerve gas in the world. Like, he was working for Hitler's war machine. So he developed a nerve gas, and one of his jobs was to develop a so-called truth drug. Because the Nazis were always paranoid. Like, they were like enemies always, everywhere. Like, especially Hitler was like, there were a lot of attempts on his life. So he was always like, who's against us? Who's for us? Who's like, so the truth drug, that was a German idea, a Gestapo NSS idea. We're going to find a truth drug, because they had been frustrated with especially Polish resistance fighters. You could torture them, they wouldn't talk. So that for the Gestapo was like, we need something else. We need to be able to make people talk, even if they don't want to talk. Even if we torture them, they don't want to talk. We need something. This was the truth drug idea, and Kuhn was responsible for finding the truth drug. So that's why Kuhn was very interested in this LSD. The idea was, can we, you know, use that in interrogations and so overpower someone's mind and then extract all the secrets? That's exactly what they did in Dachau. So I could, you know, then make the connection. In Dachau, that's exactly what they were attempting to do with mescaline and with LSD. And LSD is much better than mescaline, because mescaline, another psychedelic compound, has a bitter taste, and it's much more expensive to make it. So you can't really give it into someone's coffee. Someone will drink the coffee and immediately sense that there was something in the coffee. But LSD doesn't taste. It's odorless, tasteless, easy to manufacture in huge quantities. So LSD is like the intelligence service Gestapo's dream. Except that it doesn't work. I mean, it is a truth drug in the way that you come closer to your own truth, but it works in a way that if you give someone LSD without telling that person, you can really make that person lose his or her stability, or, you know, you can fuck someone up with giving some, sorry, my Langhamtitis, I was looking for a different word. Like, you can abuse LSD by giving it to someone, but you can't really then make that person tell all the secrets. It just doesn't work. But that, they didn't know that. So they started with these experiments in Dachau. And then Dachau was liberated. These experiments were done. I mean, he received this in late 43. So they did this in 44. The war was already going very bad for Nazi Germany. So there was a lot of chaos, and it was hard to do science. I mean, science in the concentration camp is ridiculous anyhow, because it's often just torture. They did a lot of science. I mean, you all know Dr. Mengele and all these, you know, creeps. And this was also a human experiment done in Dachau on people, giving them LSD. And when the Americans, you know, liberated the camp, they took all the findings. And the Americans always thought that what the Nazis are interested in, that could be interesting for us. Because right after World War II, the Cold War started, and suddenly the Americans are looking for a truth drug, and the Americans are creating in 1947 the CIA. They didn't have a central intelligence agency before. It was just the intelligence was with the military. Suddenly they have a central intelligence agency, and they take over the LSD research that the US military had somehow started, like a little bit, but they weren't really going for it. But then the CIA really went for it. They created a program called MK Ultra. There was a guy called Sidney Gottlieb who was responsible, and he did human experiments in America, basically continuing the Nazi LSD experiments in America. This is not so important. This was the SS guy that did it in Dachau. The Americans captured him and wrote about him. This basically because of this guy, LSD then later became illegal. Because why? You say CIA then tried it out. Did a lot of LSD illegal, unethical, horrible experiments with American citizens. They even had they even set up an apartment, for example, in San Francisco. This is a CIA agent. She is a sex worker. She gave her clients LSD without telling them, and then this was all recorded. Like, do people react differently? Does the intimate life change? Like, these are just two questions out of like 20,000 questions that the CIA was examining. Can we manipulate people with and through LSD? And because of his program, Sandoz CEO Stoll also received a visit from Gottlieb in his office in Basel, where he was basically told, LSD, you're not going to sell this. This is not going to be a medicine for everybody. This is of national interest to the United States. And if you want to sell your other products in the United States, you better comply with us. I mean, it's okay, right? This LSD. Why don't you develop like antipsychotics and antidepressants? People have to take them every day. You make much more money, you know? This LSD, you know, you just take it once and you understand your problems and you're healthy. It's not good for a pharmaceutical company. Stoll understood that in a second. So he was like, okay, let's do it. It's really as sad as I just presented it. And then CIA also involved artists in the 60s. John Lennon at one point said, we have to thank the CIA. They gave us LSD. One of the guinea pigs that was involved in these unethical experiments, for example, was a colleague of mine, Ken Kesey. He got $75 for taking LSD. So he knew he was taking LSD. Like, some people didn't know, he knew. Then he had to write a report. What he actually did, he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because he was working in a psychiatric ward in Menlo Park, California, and he suddenly understood, like, on LSD, what is madness and what is normal and what is, you know. So he wrote this amazing book and became one of the LSD gurus, basically. So LSD spilled over from the CIA into the counterculture. And then when it was too much in the mid-60s, when millions of Americans were taking it and going out on the streets, demonstrating against the Vietnam War, at one point, U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson pulled the plug and made LSD illegal in 1966. And since then, all the also legit research on LSD, which had always kind of continued in universities worldwide, had to be stopped. And we basically lost, because it picks up now again slowly, as I mentioned in the beginning. We have lost 50 crucial years for developing something like a medicine against dementia, something like a good medicine against depression. And I can't get into the detail. You have to read the book. There's so much more in it. We have to come to the Q&A soon, but let me wrap up the story. Okay, we leave it at that because it's a nice picture. I came back with that crazy story to my father and to my mother, and we discussed it in the family. It actually, the discussion around LSD created a lot of exchange in the family, which was not there before, which was a very nice byproduct of this whole book. That's why it's my favorite book, maybe because it's become such a personal thing. And on Mother's Day, about three years ago, on Mother's Day, my mother received the first dosage. She agreed, and a small dosage, obviously. And it was on our balcony in a small town in southwest Germany. And my father also took a drop, 10 micrograms. He didn't feel anything. He said, they just sold you water. I could feel it because I know the effect. If you take a microdose, it's like drinking maybe two espressi. Yeah. It's like, you can feel it. You have a stimulation going on, and it doesn't wear off like a coffee after 30 minutes. It keeps on for maybe 3 hours, 4 hours. So I think it's a great effect. My father didn't feel anything. He never feels anything. We have to say. Which is also connected to the Nazis, because his father was fighting in Russia and came back and had no more feelings. raising him without feelings, never said, I love you, nothing. You know, that's also how I grew up a little bit. That's the German thing. We could talk about this another 45 minutes at least. So what's happening with my mother, though? She's like suddenly, like she was redder, like she was more animated. And suddenly she picks up the newspaper, which she hadn't even looked at as an object for about a year. She picks up the newspaper and starts reading the headlines to us. And on that note, I want to conclude and thank you very much.